I tried to take this approach everywhere that I've been. Work that job like it's the last place you're ever going to be. Work that job like it's your 30-year position that you're going to retire from. You know, and if you take that approach day in and day out, and so I think you always have to approach wherever you are and work hard to make that the place you might be forever. You would be amazed, Sheets, at how much fun those guys had during that lightning delay.
I guarantee it.
The goofiness and the silliness and the laughs, the smiles. And finally, I had to do it. I sort of stopped everybody. They were laughing and goofing on each other. And I said, I hope you guys realize how special this is.
Oh.
And I've been around teams all my life. And I don't ever remember being around a group of guys that loved being around each other as much as you guys do.
You're dialed in to the ABCA's Calls from the Clubhouse podcast, connecting our coaches with some of the best baseball minds in our game. Now here's your host, Jeremy Schiedinger.
Broadcasting from the ABCA National Office here in Greensboro, North Carolina, welcome back or welcome to our Calls from the Clubhouse podcast. This is your baseball coaching source for certified audio gold and the place you come to connect with the very best baseball minds in our game. This is your weekly fix for baseball-centered conversations that will help you grow as a leader. These chats will help you grow as a coach and a steward of baseball. You dial in each week to challenge yourself and your thoughts on the game, and our podcast brings you into the dugout with our guest. You can pull up a bucket with us and take notes from one of the very best out there having success on the diamond. So thanks to each and every one of you guys for clicking into this week's show. Before we get into the details of this episode, we have to hit you with the reminders to subscribe, review, and share the keys to growing this network of listeners. So on your phone, your computer, your tablet, hit subscribe to this podcast. You'll never miss another show. You can also leave us a review on there, leave us a rating. That helps more folks find the show. And go the extra step, jump the action gap, and share this podcast. This is just like sharing a great book with some of your friends. You know, when you say, hey, just finish this one up and you're going to love it. Or maybe it's a great recipe or a movie recommendation. We do these things all the time. Just do the same for this podcast. The baseball community around you would appreciate you investing in their development. Taking a few minutes to say, hey, I'm digesting this audio gold each week. You should too. And then let's discuss your takeaways. That's the powerful opportunity we have each week to share these shows, included in your social media post. We'd love to hear how these shows are hitting each of you on the other end of the call. Connect with us on social media. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. Find us at ABCA1945. You can also head over to our website, abca.org, if you're looking for more information about what our baseball coaches fraternity is all about. Also, please feel to reach out to me directly on Twitter at CoachSheets3 or by email, Sheets, S-H-E-E-T-S, at abca.org. The feedback keeps pouring in by the truckload, and we love it. It's awesome to have that stuff come in. It makes our day to hear how we're positively changing the culture in coaching. College coaches, they're out there burning up the highways on the recruiting trails. You've got high school and travel coaches, they're running from tournament to tournament this summer. And those guys are all earning degrees from Automobile University. You've also got guys who are listening to these shows while they're working out. They're taking classes at the Elliptical College. And all of us are still maintaining our yards or cutting grass at our ballparks this summer under the mantra of keep growing while we're mowing. Keep us posted on how these are working for you all. We'd love to hear from each and every one of you guys on that. Which brings us to this week's podcast. And let me paint the picture for our guest. A 21-year continuous member inside the ABCA who took over a program 6 years ago who hadn't been to the NCAA postseason since 1961. He took them to two NCAA regionals, the program's first ever super regional appearance this past season, five straight 30-win seasons, the program's first 40-win campaign, and he set the school record for wins and ACC wins. It's nothing short of unreal to see the work that Duke University head coach Chris Pollard and his staff have done revitalizing this program as Chris enters his seventh year as skipper of the Blue Devils. So inside this show, Pollard opens up his path in baseball, including finding himself as a head coach at the tender age of 24, to doing more with less. A powerful segment of this interview where Chris offers his perspective on not letting the lack of resources get in your way. Instead, maximize and focus on the resources that you do have. Some great stuff in that. plus his thoughts on embracing technology, even as a self-proclaimed non-tech savvy coach, and the details behind one of the great stories in college baseball, building up the baseball program at a quote-unquote basketball school into one of the elite inside Division I baseball. So let's not waste another second. Let's dive right in and connect with the head coach of Duke University, Chris Pollard. He's our guest on this week's Calls from the Clubhouse podcast. And get ready, coaches. This great show is coming at you right now. Coaches, thanks for dialing into our Calls from the Clubhouse podcast. We've got a tremendous episode on deck for you today. In my opinion, one of the great people inside college baseball, a rising star in college baseball. But what's been awesome is we're going to get the details behind the story of building up a program that honestly had no national relevance, and a guy that's come in and really put his stamp on a program and brought it to the elite inside of baseball. We're going to welcome in the seventh-year head coach of the Duke University Blue Devils, Chris Pollard. Chris, thanks for jumping on the call with us.
Sheets, thanks for having me on. Excited to be here.
We're excited to have you. I do have to tell you, though, now I'm bringing on a guy from Duke University, and I've got a lot of Kentucky blood running through these veins. There's a chance that my family disowns me because of this interview, but I thought it was well worth the time.
So what you're saying is no Leitner references during the entire interview.
Well, there's one.
That's right.
Yeah, I won't bring that up. That was a night I will remember vividly. But no, it's an easy choice to get you on here. We were talking before we got recording. What you've done there at Duke, and we're going to get into all that, has been nothing short of astounding. But where we always start and where we always like to begin our shows, Chris, anybody that comes on these podcasts, you are an ABCA member. You are a proud and loyal ABCA member. And obviously your experience inside the association is deep and it's full, and attending conventions. You even hosted a Barnstormers event last fall. If you could just talk through what the ABCA has meant to you over your career and what it's meant to see this thing really grow and flourish.
Sure. Well, I was fortunate to play for Dick Cook at Davidson and start my coaching career under him, and in my going into my second season as an assistant at Davidson College, 97-98, Coach Cook suggested, he's, of course, a longtime loyal ABCA member as well, suggested that it made sense for me to participate in the convention and to join the ABCA as a young coach. I was probably 24 years old, 23 years old at the time. And so my first convention was in San Diego. Mm-hmm. And a couple of decades later, or over a couple of decades later, have attended every one since, and been a continuous member of the organization ever since. And the older I get, Sheets, and the longer I do this, the more I realize the importance of our organization and of our fraternity. Mm-hmm. And not just for moving the needle in our sport, but just the camaraderie. I've developed so many friendships over the years as part of the ABCA, but it's also shaped a lot of what we do on the field. Every year, I come back from the convention and there's something I've scribbled down on one of the outlines that we work hard to put into place, you know, immediately in our spring preparation for that upcoming season. You mentioned the Barnstormers event. I loved that concept as a extension of what we do with the convention.
Sure.
Because it was a more intimate atmosphere. There was more back and forth exchange, and I've had several coaches that have come up to me over the summer just out and about who were at our Barnstormers event in Durham and just talk about the impact that had on some things they were doing on the field and on their season that they just finished up.
That's outstanding. We appreciate that. And again, as we grow this thing to be on the ground floor, that's the way I try to sell it to you, is like, I'm being on the ground floor of this thing as this continues to grow. This year, taking 20 events, but we're going national. We're going from coast to coast. So we appreciate your loyalty to the association, Chris, what that's meant to you. And that means a lot to us from where we sit for sure. You mentioned Dick Cook, obviously the loyal ABCA member, your time at Davidson. And I want you to kind of go through each stop in the journey, every place that you've been. And I think another key question inside that, Chris, as you detail that out, what was maybe the important lesson that you learned there? What was the one thing when you look back at your time at Davidson or App State where you look back and you go, man, I really needed to learn that, and I walked away with a better knowledge?
Tremendous respect for Dick Cook and all that he's accomplished. It was an honor to get an opportunity to play for him. And then I had a chance to start my coaching career underneath him at Davidson back in 1996. And went back to Davidson, Sheets, with the intention in the fall of 96 to to work out and train in anticipation of an invite to spring training. I had played a season of independent ball right after graduated, jumped on a plane, flew to California, and signed as a member of the Salinas Peppers in the now defunct Western League, and bounced around a couple of different stops: Sioux Falls, South Dakota, Alexandria, Louisiana, trying to chase that professional baseball dream. But I was a 5'11" right-handed pitcher that threw 84 miles an hour, and there's not a tremendous market for those guys.
No.
Went back to Davidson, and I was working out, and the deal was, hey, Chris, come back and you can train, but we want you to help out with the pitching staff and hit fungos and throw some BP every once in a while. And had an opportunity presented to me that fall to join the coaching staff with Chris McMullen and the Rocky Mount Rockfish in the inaugural year of the Coastal Plain League. And I'll never forget, Matt called me and said, hey, I'd like you to come be a pitching guy for me in the summer in this new collegiate summer league. It's going to be a lot like the Cape. And I hung up the phone, and I was, you know, grateful for the offer and hung up the phone. And at the time, my roommate was Brett Baretti, who was the head coach at Columbia. He and I played together in college at Davidson, and we were rooming together as assistant coaches. And I said, hey, that was, you know, nice offer, but, you know, I'm headed to spring training and headed out. And he said, and he gave me some tough love, Sheets. He said, you know, you're crazy if you don't call McMullen back and take that job. I said, what do you mean I'm going to be playing? He said, Chris, you're, as I mentioned, 5'11", and you throw 84 miles an hour on a good day. He said, there's not much future for you in this game as a player, but you might have a future as a coach. And it was a message that I needed to hear. And so that's how really my coaching career got started, was with one of my teammates telling me I wasn't good enough to play anymore.
Tough love, baby.
And yeah, no question. And it was some of the best advice I ever got. So I spent that time there with Coach at Davidson. And one of the things I've always appreciated about those 4 years as an assistant at Davidson is that, as Coach has done with all his assistants over the years, he gave me a ton of responsibility. He's a great delegator. He trusts his people. And he gave me a long enough leash to make a lot of mistakes and learn as I went through those mistakes, both on the recruiting side and on the, you know, the coaching side on the field. And, you know, I really credit Coach with sort of learning how to play the game. I came from a small high school in a rural area and had some ability, but didn't really know how to play the game, especially from a mental approach to the game, and learned a lot during my time there as a player, but even more so as a coach underneath him for 4 years. In 1999, it was June of 1999. Back then there was very little internet activity, Sheets. I mean, I'm dating myself now, but we used the NCAA, you know, journal to kind of find out what jobs were open. And there was, it was like the one ads, you know, and so I was leafing through those, sitting in the office, and saw that the head coaching position at Pfeiffer University was open. Had heard of Pfeiffer just driving up and down 85, but didn't know anything about it, the school, and went over and interviewed, and a couple weeks later, here it was, picking up and moving to the metropolitan area of Meisenheimer, North Carolina.
That's it.
I would never forget on the interview, I was walking around with Jeff Childress, and I said, hey, Jeff, how close is the campus to Meisenheimer? He said, you're standing on it, man. That was it. It was a post office and a gas station, and that was all that existed. But, you know, 5 years at Pfeiffer. I started out there at 24 years old. It was a great learning experience. You got to learn on the fly. You were enough below the radar at that level. At the time, it was in the Carolinas Virginia Athletic Conference, and we were enough below the radar that you could make your mistakes, and you weren't on the hot seat because of them. And made a lot of mistakes during that time, but learned a lot from them. We had a bunch of local kids. The vast majority of our roster were local North Carolina kids, and they were blue collar tough, and we all kind of got better over that 4 or 5 years together. And then the last couple of years there in 2004 and 2005, we were fortunate to have a lot of success. And in June of 2004, the opportunity presented itself at Appalachian State. just like when I left Davidson, I had a lot of folks who said, boy, you're crazy to leave Davidson. You're crazy to leave the Division I level to go coach at a Division II school. You'll have a hard time ever getting back to the Division I level. Well, then fast forward 5 years, when I left Pfeiffer, everybody said, you're crazy to leave Pfeiffer. You've got the engine humming. You're winning ball games. You're going to go up to Boone, and it's going to be cold, and it's a football school, and they don't care about baseball, and you're crazy to take that job. But I always felt like Appalachian, what a great academic school. It was an attractive school to North Carolina kids. We'd been recruiting a lot of North Carolina kids at Pfeiffer, and you know, we were really fortunate that we had an athletic director, Charlie Cobb, who invested in our program, saw the vision for the fact that baseball could be a winning sport at Appalachian State, and invested in facilities and really got behind us. And that program just got a little better every year. Mm-hmm. And then we finally, after having 5 or 6 30-win seasons, we finally broke through with a 40-win season in 2012, and had a really neat run into the NCAA tournament, and mm-hmm. was on the bus back from Charlottesville, where we just lost out to Oklahoma the night before in a championship game of that Charlottesville regional, and a 919 number popped up in my phone, and I thought it was a scout because the draft was going on, and we've got all these guys, young men in the back of the bus who are watching their phones and wondering what's going to happen with the draft. So I let it click to voicemail, thinking, well, okay, I'll deal with that when we get back to campus. And after I saw the voicemail pop up, I listened to it, and it was a representative from Duke asking if I'd be interested in coming over and talking about the position. And yeah, a week later, you know, packing bags and moving to Durham, North Carolina. And once again, Cheats, and I think this is a great lesson for a lot of young coaches that are out there. I had people that tell me I was crazy to leave Appalachian State, yeah, to come to Duke. And, you know, there was apathy around the program, that there was a tradition of losing, that it was a basketball school. And I think the lesson learned through all of that is, and as I've told guys this, there's no place that's perfect. Every school, whether it was Pfeiffer or a tiny school in a rural area with a 500 full-time enrollment and really challenged from a budget standpoint, a resources standpoint, or whether it's Appalachian State and you're up in the mountains and it's cold and you're going to deal with the snow and those challenges, or whether it's Duke and you're coming to a program that's got a pretty tough track record over the previous 55 years, and it's a school that's known for basketball and lacrosse and golf, not mm-hmm. baseball. You have to kind of tackle those challenges head on. You know, you know, and understand that also wherever you are, even though there are going to be some challenges, there's positives to every situation. There were a whole lot of positives about our situation at Pfeiffer. Appalachian State was full of positive opportunities and things that you could sell to recruits. And obviously, a place like Duke and the academic reputation and the ACC and everything that goes along with those two things is there's a whole lot of positives about our situation here, but nowhere is perfect.
Yeah. You know, and I'm going to jump on that real quick, because I think this is the time, you know, this summer when coaches are looking and job opportunities are popping up and guys are making calls and shooting texts and we're having these conversations. And I think for anyone that's wanting to be a head coach, it'd be awesome to look at however many buckets, Chris, we feel like we have to have, whether that's administrative support, budget, scholarships, recruiting base. Let's say there's 10 doors there. It'd be great to walk in a situation and see all 10 doors wide open. But that, I don't know if that exists. I think anywhere, any program you can look at, the ones that have had tremendous success to the ones that haven't, there's doors that are closed at each situation. And I think you've got to recognize that. Is there a way that I can open that? Can I go find a key to open that door? These doors are open, and maybe I can walk through them and really take advantage of those opportunities. I agree with your sentiments completely, because I think so many coaches want the perfect opportunity. When is it just a place that I can go get experience as a coach? Can I win a little bit? And again, not to say stepping stone, but can I really make something of this spot so that somebody else wants to come calling for me? You see it that way?
Without question, there's a book, the Mind Gym, and it's a great mm-hmm. read. I had a mm-hmm. faculty athletics representative that gave it to me actually when I was at Pfeiffer, and there's a terrific quote in the Mind Gym, and it says, those that do well with the tools they have tend to get more tools. and that's always stuck with me.
Yeah.
You know, you make the most of the resources that you have, and folks recognize that, and they tend to want to get behind you and support you. And I think the other thing, in terms of, it's a great piece of advice on your part. The other advice that I would give to young guys out there, and I really tried to, even though I don't know that I did it consciously, I tried to take this approach everywhere that I've been. Work that job like it's the last place you're ever going to be.
Mm.
Work that job like it's your 30-year position that you're going to retire from. You know, and if you take that approach day in and day out, when I was at Pfeiffer, you know, my wife and I, we didn't have kids at the time. We thought, boy, we might be here. This might be
yeah.
it, you know, and
yep.
what a great little community to raise family in. And then got to Appalachian and fell in love with Boone, and you start to develop relationships and you plant roots. And then we had a couple of kids come along the way, and you start to think, boy, this may be where we raise our children.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly I look at Duke and now blessed with the contract extension and say, you know what, I'm about to turn 44 years old. This might be the place I retire from. And so I think you always have to approach wherever you are and work hard to make that the place you might be forever.
I love it. Love that note. Going to this, I was thinking as you were going through that, your early years. So certainly your first few years at Davidson, maybe it's becoming a first year young head coach at Pfeiffer, and really starting to figure some things out. So go back to those early years. And if you can pinpoint what motivated you then to coach, and we certainly, there's so many things that come from this, but specific to you, Chris, what motivated you then to coach? And then also, how has that motivation changed over the years? How have you developed from what really gets you going, what really defines your why in coaching? How's that grown over the past few years?
Yeah, it's changed a lot. And I think fatherhood does that to you. I think your experiences of working with players does that to you. When I first got into coaching, and I referenced the opportunity to go and coach as a college assistant to be a coach in a collegiate summer league environment, and then I owe a lot to Pete Bach, who gave me an opportunity to be a head coach in that same Coastal Plain League in the second year of its existence. And what I found in that summer as a head coach, and ironically in Durham, the Durham Braves in the Coastal Plain League, was that same adrenaline rush that I felt as a player, that same intensity, that same feeling that we all have from competing.
Mm-hmm.
I realized, wow, you can get that same feeling from coaching. For me, the motivation early on in coaching was the competition. You know, I prided okay. myself on being a fierce competitor as a player, an intense competitor. And I really enjoyed the one-on-one battle as a pitcher with the hitter. And that adrenaline was a feeling that I loved as a young coach.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that I was a great practice coach. I don't know that I was great from an organization standpoint, and perhaps not even nearly as good as I would have wanted to be from a relationship standpoint.
Mm.
But that was what motivated me, was the opportunity to compete. As I get older, I still enjoy competing. I tell our players, and I told some kids in camp a couple weeks ago, I said, never been a game in 35 years in baseball, going back to 8 years old, never been a game I didn't show up at the ballpark, I didn't have butterflies.
Yeah.
And that feeling I still have every single time I have an opportunity to put on the uniform and compete against somebody in the other dugout. But the motivation changes. And now for me, and I know you, young coaches hear old coaches say this, and they probably give the eye roll, but they will change, and they will appreciate this too as they get a little longer in the tooth. It's way more about relationships.
Yep.
And I have so much fun in watching our players develop. The pride I took at seeing our guys that had an opportunity to go on in this year's draft, and remembering them in the recruiting process, and remembering them when they rolled on the campus 3 and 4 years ago, and they were the deer in the headlights look, and you know, and they had those moments in the fall of their freshman year when they wondered if they were even good enough to be at this level, or could they compete? Could they keep up with the guys around them? And now they're the guys out there that our freshmen now look to and wonder the same things. I just like seeing our guys develop, and I love seeing our guys develop personally. It's really rewarding when you get a guy, whether you're coaching at the high school level or whether you're coaching at the college or any level, to get a guy and to watch him grow as a human being. You know, to see an 18-year-old come in here and maybe he lacks maturity and maybe he lacks organization, and to watch him grow through his time in your program and to really watch that guy grow into a grown man by the time he leaves, and see how much he has developed, not just as a player, but as a person. That part of it is really what motivates me nowadays.
It's outstanding. You know, I was just reflecting, man, when we started this podcast, it was, you know, we're really going to break it down. We're going to get into the nuts and bolts of infield play and catching and hitting and all the different fundamentals. And we certainly do that. But the theme that kept coming up early, and it's come up ever since, and it's something that's really, Chris, I can't tell you how much it's changed and morphed my perception of how valuable this platform can be, is to deliver that message right there for any coach that's listening. I know you want to chase wins. I've done it. You've done it. I know you want to chase wins. I know that's what makes our heart fill up. At the same time, fill your heart with relationships and really do it for the kids. Keep the kids number one. If you do that, like you mentioned, things are going to fall into place. And I just love the fact that you echo that sentiment, because that certainly comes out in every single show that we put out. I want to go into this, man, and I want to blow some smoke at you, but it's all well-deserved. And I think it paints the landscape for this question. You know, you mentioned the contract extension, so you're going to be a Blue Devil for quite a few years. You're right up the street from me. That's good for me. I get to come watch you guys play. But what you've done there inside of 6 years, man, again, like, is nothing short of outstanding. When you look at the program's first two NCAA tournament bids since 1961, that's happened under your watch. 5 consecutive 30-plus win seasons, the program's first ever super regional appearance. You set the school record for wins. You set the school record for ACC wins. Plus, you put a coach into professional baseball as one of your assistants moved on. When you look at taking that Duke job, when everybody told you were crazy, a program that did not have a storied, successful history, what's been the process? What's been the journey to elevating that program? Take us to day one, and then work our way up through those 6 years to where you sit in the big chair of year 7.
Well, you know, in terms of the wins and losses sheets, and I think most coaches would say this, that the simple answer is it comes down to getting good players. Everywhere I've ever been, we've always won more when we've had good players. But one of the things that attracted me to Duke, and likewise to Appalachian State, was I believed very strongly in the product that we had to sell. And I think you have to really believe in what you're selling to players for it to work. And in the case of Duke, you have a world-class academic institution. And you know, I tell, and to this day, I'm in year 7, I tell people this, I've yet to pick up the phone and speak with a player, a potential recruit, a prospective student athlete, or his family, and have them not recognize the name Duke, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, sure. You know, so I've talked to kids all over the country and literally all over the world, and I've yet to encounter a kid that didn't have an immediate recognizability with the Duke brand.
That's it.
And so that is powerful. And the opportunity to pursue a Duke diploma is powerful. Mm. And then you combine that with playing baseball in the ACC, it's a great product to sell. Mm-hmm. Now, that being said, you know, we had to work and we had to bring a caliber of player in here that was going to put us in a position to do the things we've done over the last couple of years. So much of the credit for where we are goes back to the players that were already here at Duke we got here. Mm-hmm. And that's a credit to Coach McNally and the job that he did. But it was also a credit to those players who stuck with us as coaches and were willing to buy in very early on after we got to Durham, after our staff got to Durham. You know, and you need that, because if you don't have that, you may not get to a point where you can establish culture. People talk about establishing culture and you know, well, you can't have a culture unless the guys in the locker room buy into that culture.
That's it.
You know, and ultimately, and the thing I think maybe that I've learned the most, and really I've learned this over the last couple of years, is that coaches really don't establish culture. Players establish culture. Coaches set a tone, and they lay out objectives, and we can help guys develop a process, and we can help guys with goal setting. But ultimately, it's the guys in the locker room that are either going to embrace that or not embrace that.
Mm-hmm.
And we were really fortunate that in those first couple of years that we were at Duke, we had a group of guys that were willing to buy in, that were here at Duke for the right reasons, and that sped up our learning curve, if you will, and it allowed us to gain traction and maybe be a little bit further along, particularly in years two and three, than we would have been if we'd have taken an approach which said, look, we're going to go in there and we're going to blow this thing up and we're going to bring in all new guys, you know. And so I know that there's a lot of different ways to go about it, but we had a group of really good kids here who were close to graduating, close to getting their Duke degrees, and that's something that can open a lot of doors over
that's
a lifetime.
Right.
And so we, you know, those guys stayed and they grinded it out with us. And because of that, and because of their ability to embrace what we were trying to do, I think it got us closer to where we are this, coming out of this 2018 season. It's not rocket science. So, I mean, what we do, we're in a people business.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got work ethic and you got some people skills, I think those are the two most important qualities in coaching. The X's and O's side of it, well, that part of it tends to work itself out. And we ultimately, at the end of the day, we don't play a real complicated sport. We don't out scheme a lot of people in this sport like a football or basketball does. You're trying to get guys to be in the right position.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to get guys to play hard, and you're trying to get guys to do it day after day in a sport that, you know, can be a grind just with the length of our season. And so we talk a lot about process. We talk a lot about the routine development. We talk about developing our mental toughness through an ability to control our heart rate, to control our breath. We call it clearing the clutter. I've learned a lot from Ken Revizzo over the years, and a lot of that's come from sitting in the audience at ABCA events, at the
sure.
conventions. I learned a lot about how to approach our coaching from listening to guys like that sitting in the audience. And then we talk a lot about a culture of servant leadership sheets, and that's something that we've really tried to embrace more over the last few years, and I think that's made a bigger difference in our culture, because not only are guys figuring out what their own individual process is, but now they're learning how to use their own individual process to make the guys around them better. You know, and we define servant leadership pretty simply as caring more about the people around you than you do about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can adopt that as a core principle of what you do, it's amazing what you can do to elevate the people around you. But also, when you work hard and focus on the people around you, it's amazing what it does for your own head and how it allows you to clear the clutter in your own head. And what we talk with guys that are struggling a lot, Cheats, was, you know, it's natural in our sport because it is a sport of failure.
Sure.
You know, guys get a lot going on, a lot of distractions, whether it's the draft or whether it's academics or whether it's the fact that you're 0-19. You get a lot of things running around up there in your head, and all of a sudden you can make this game really complicated. But it's amazing if you just focus on picking up a teammate or you focus on getting involved in something that's going on in your community, the perspective that gives you and the gratitude it gives you for where you are and the opportunities that you've been given, it's amazing how that will very quickly clear some of that clutter.
You know, as you're talking through that, I'm hearing the part about servant leadership, and a word that's come through this podcast quite a bit is the word mudita, which is a Sanskrit word for vicarious joy in another's success. And I'm
absolutely,
I mean, it's like a parent, and what screams to me, you know, getting to watch you guys play throughout the season, then obviously supers and the regionals this year, to watch your guys, that servant leadership is apparent. That Mudita feeling is apparent. You see guys jump the rail and get out at home plate or go grab a guy off the mound. It's apparent on your team. So I want to ask you, if you could, take us inside that dugout. What's it sound like? What's the you outlined the culture so beautifully, but what does it really sound like? What is maybe the style of play that you think defines Duke baseball?
We talk an awful lot about playing with energy, and you know, energy is infectious and it's contagious, but positive energy and negative energy are equally contagious, you
That's
know?
Right.
And so,
yeah,
you know, we talk, you know, and I read the book, The Energy Bus, right when I got to Duke. That's a great read for coaches, I think. And, you know, it references energy vampires. And, you know, and we talk a lot with our guys about the fact that you're either an energy giver or an energy taker. And we want to surround ourselves with energy givers. And it's amazing when you put energy givers around you, how you tend to be an energy giver yourself. And so it's very rare that we don't end a pregame huddle specifically addressing energy and the importance of it. And this team this year really embraced that. And, you know, we all have experiences and coaches where some years guys will embrace your core principles and your culture better than others. Mm-hmm. And this team certainly had a lot of talent, but I don't know that I ever had a team that embraced the culture as well as this team. And you know, it's very cliched in our business, not just baseball, but in sports, to talk about the value of leadership. But I watched and witnessed firsthand this year how important leadership is, because we spent very little time as coaches steering the culture and steering the energy as our leaders, our captains really took the reins for that. And that was fun to watch, just to take a step back and watch those guys hold each other accountable. But it was, you know, people have commented to me a lot this summer on how fun we were to watch. Well, it was fun to be there in the dugout with those guys. They were poised. They were professional. They were tough. But the interesting thing was, and I don't know the answer to this. This is a chicken or the egg kind of question.
Sure.
They also had a love for being around one another. And I want to share this story. We were in what felt like about our 18th rain delay / lightning delay of the NCAA tournament.
Right.
When we were down in the Super Regional at Lubbock, it was a Saturday game, and obviously we were the Sunday game, and we were facing elimination again. We'd lost a heartbreaker in the first game of that series with Texas Tech, and we had another lightning delay. And so here we are huddled up in this temporary locker room space, and it turned out to be a longer delay than they were telling us it was going to be. It wound up being more like an hour and a half. We thought maybe it'd only be 30 minutes. You would be amazed, Sheets, at how much fun those guys had during that lightning delay.
I guarantee it.
The goofiness and the silliness and the laughs and the smiles. And finally, I had to do it. We were probably 50 minutes to an hour into the lightning delay, and we weren't sure when we were going to start back up again. We knew we were going to start up sometime, and we knew we were potentially, you know, a bad nine innings away from a season coming to an end. And I sort of stopped everybody. They were laughing and goofing on each other, and I said, "I hope you guys realize how special this is."
Oh.
And I said, "I've been around teams all my life, and I don't ever remember being around a group of guys that loved being around each other as much as you guys do." And I said, "You need to understand how rare this is and appreciate it, because here we are. We've spent countless hours together since August, right? This team's been together hours and hours. And then when you get into postseason play, and you're traveling, you're together basically every minute. You're eating together, you're sleeping together, you're practicing together. And so it's natural to kind of fray, your nerves kind of fray with one another. That group never had that. They just enjoyed each other's time all the way up until the very end. And that was one of the things that made this year such a special thing to be a part of.
You know you're having a good conversation, and you know it's a good story when the other person gets goosebumps. I appreciate that story. That I will reflect on that later today, Chris. That is a, and I'm so glad you found that moment. You felt that moment. Hopefully, they remember that moment moving forward, because that definitely is
absolutely rare.
Absolutely. You know, I want to go into technology real quick, because being around you guys and knowing Coach Steen the way I do and seeing you guys work, I know that technology has its role and its place in your program. So if you could just open up, maybe how do you guys leverage that technology to really strengthen what you're doing on the field? And then more than that, how has that challenged you as a coach? Because we talked about not having emails at one point. So here we are with technologies prevalent in your programs.
Right.
How's that challenged you?
First, full disclosure, I am inherently a bad technology person.
There you go.
I'll never forget Dick Cook saying to me back in 1997, he said, "Hey, I think that recruits are going to be emailing us." This is back when email was like a year old.
Sure.
I think the way that we're going to contact recruits is through email. I said, "Come on, coach, that'll never happen." And now we have, social media and the like. And so and I'm a guy that struggles with the remote control. Like, I have to give the remote control to my 10-year-old to get the TV turned on. So it doesn't come natural for me. But the neat thing is being at a place like Duke stretches you and it pushes you. And we talk about as a program, we talk about it as a staff, we talk about it with our players, when you're surrounded by excellence, you have to up your game, and not just in athletics here at Duke, but in academics and in the medical center and beyond. But that's probably been the biggest change in our on-the-field dynamic in terms of the way we work with our players from a development standpoint has been a willingness to embrace technology. And it's forced us, and you referenced Coach Steen. I'm incredibly proud of Jason Steen and the job he's done with our hitters. You look at the draft and guys like Griffin Conine and Jimmy Herron and Chris Proctor, and the list goes on. But Jason and I are from that same generation.
Oh yeah,
we played together in college, and we got our start in coaching about the same time, and we also have about the same amount of technological savvy, and which is to say not much, but to watch our staff embrace technology, and you guys did it with the Barnstormers event, and a product like Blast, and what that's doing to transform our game and transform the offensive side of things. It's helped us become better coaches. And certainly you see it nowadays, both in offensive development and pitching development, with products that are out there, whether it's Hittrax or whether it's Blast or Diamond Kinetics. There's tons of great products out there that are helping guys develop offensively. And obviously we've learned a lot about angles and launch angles and exit velocities and steepness of barrel and point of contact. I could go on and on. But it's helped us become way more scientific in the way that we coach our players. And then on the pitching side of it, you have products like Rapsodo and TrackMan. And you have a video product that's out there now, like Synergy, and you have, bats and dartfish, and we're able to really coach players more individually now than we ever have, which is very cool, because I think that's how today's player wants to be coached. We're able to bring a player in and do very detailed video analysis and have access to literally hundreds and hundreds of at bats and be able to select any pitch of any ball game and go back and evaluate that particular pitch or that particular swing. Obviously it's made a huge difference in how we prepare for our opponents, but now it's even making a huge difference in terms of how we recruit, because we now know, Sheets, that not all 88 mile an hour fastballs are created equal.
That's right.
An 88 mile an hour fastball with a 2100 RPM spin rate from a release point that has 6 foot of extension is very, very different from an 88 mile an hour fastball that might have 2500 RPMs of spin rate and is released from 7 feet of extension. And oh, by the way, might have 28 inches of induced vertical rise. Those are two very different pitches. One tends to get hit in the gap and one gets a lot of swings and misses. And we have access to a ton of information nowadays, not only to help guys develop, but to evaluate guys. And, you know, there's a tremendous story out there relative to this about Preston Morrison, who pitched at TCU. And I'm a part of this story because I'm one of a ton of coaches that passed on Preston Morrison. And Preston Morrison was a Charlotte area player, played for Jason Hill with the Ondeckos, a great baseball mind and a good friend. And I was at Appalachian State at the time, and he kept trying to sell me on Preston Morrison. And but Jason, he's 82 miles an hour. This guy can pitch, Chris. He can pitch. He's 82. We don't have a spot for him. And Preston Morrison goes to TCU and becomes the most decorated pitcher in the history of one of the best programs in all of college baseball.
Sure.
Because we know now that 82-mile-an-hour fastball is one of the great outliers in college baseball in the last 10 years because it had an unbelievably low spin rate. It had an incredible amount of induced vertical break or what we used to call sink on the fastball. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, technology is really changing our game. I think the thing we have to be careful of, and we fight this all the time with our staff sheets, and I know as you talk with coaches out there, you probably hear this a lot. We have to be careful about two things. One is drowning in the data. Mm-hmm. So we have so much data out there. We got to decide what's most important. What has the greatest impact on player development and putting our guys in a position to win? Because we can spend so much time evaluating and sifting through data that we forget to what we're really trying to do is help this information to develop players or put them in a position to be successful. And the other piece of it that we always have to fight in our sport is paralysis by analysis. Mm-hmm. You know, and that is we become so analytical with how we approach guys that we run the risk of complicating the game for them. And you know, so we were always it's like anything else in our profession. We, you know, we talk about a balance. A family / work balance. Well, you're always kind of straddling that line, and you don't always get it right. You're fighting that line, but you're trying to do the best you can. But you know, you sometimes you get too far in one direction or the other. Well, it's the same thing in terms of using technology. We're always talking as a staff about how much of this information is good to share with the player, and where do we run the risk of oversaturating a guy. Mm-hmm.
Could not have said any of that any better. I mean, I think for any coach, listen to this. Coaches are still grappling with this. I even tweeted this morning there was a great video talking about technology and why would I guess when I can measure it? That was a line that came from it. Why would I make a guess? And that's no different than recruiting and evaluation or scouting. Why would I make a guess when I can just measure it and know, like you said, the 88-mile-an-hour fastballs, I'll know the difference and I'll be able to really scout the difference and move forward with that. That's a powerful statement inside that. And I think many coaches that are grappling with technology and really finding maybe finding it tough to wrap their arms around it, I think that's softening up a little bit. I hope that it is because it's definitely not going away. And I think that's you know, Steiner and I were talking at the Barnstormers event. That's one thing, you know, having the budget that Duke has and having the capabilities to do some unique things that he couldn't do at other situations, I think that's forced him to open his eyes a little bit. There's a better way out there, and if there's a better way to do it, then you've got to embrace it because everybody else is. We just got to try to work to be at the forefront of that.
Everything in our society is adapting and changing because of technology and becoming quicker and more efficient. And, you know, it's like anything else. If you don't adapt, you fall behind. Mm-hmm. And we all run the risk of that.
That's it. I want to go into this because you're talking about cracks me up because I think if you grab the 24-year-old Chris Pollard and he heard you talk the way you just talked about spin rate, I think he'd try to smack you. But I think that's showing the evolution of a coach. And when you think about it, go back through your career. And I think from the leadership, if you could overview it, the growth inside the game for you, how have you grown as a leader? And then what were maybe the things that you picked up along the way? Like what were the lessons that you still needed to learn as you continue to mature in coaching?
Well, when I first got into coaching sheets, I think I tried to coach like Chris Pollard, the player. Mm-hmm. And I was going to be in more intense than my opponent. I was going to try to out-hustle my opponent. I was going to out-will my opponent. And I think when you use those things, I think those things work better for players than they do for coaches.
Mm-hmm.
What that can do is, you know, sometimes you confuse intensity and emotion, and at least I did as a young coach. And when those two things get confused, there tends to be some, you know, roller coaster to your personality.
That's
and
it.
There tends to be some volatility to your approach with how you deal with players.
Mm.
And over the years, and I think that parenthood helps with this, but it's not the only thing that can help with this. I think that you realize that, hey, well, rather than just focus on being the intensest guy in the dugout, let's focus on things that actually can help put players in a position to be successful. And so organization is something that I've come to to appreciate. That's something that I did not have at all as a young coach, the ability to be organized, the ability to prepare and plan before jumping in with both feet. I had a great boss one time that said, hey, aim then shoot, don't shoot then aim. And I think early on in my coaching career, I would shoot and then aim a lot.
Yeah, that's it.
And so that's a big part of it. Coaches have to delegate. Whether you're a head coach or an assistant, if you're a head coach, you got to be great at delegating to your assistants, and you got to trust those guys. If you are an assistant coach working with pitchers or working with hitters, you got to be great at delegating to your veterans, mm-hmm. to your leaders, to your captains, and allow those guys to help you work with players and get more done. So I think that's a big part of it. I think consistency of approach is huge, and mm-hmm. sometimes there's a unique balance. We just talked about the importance of technology and how we have to adapt and how we have to be open to change, and we talk all the time about, you know, being comfortable being uncomfortable, right?
Yeah,
and we
it.
Challenge players with this. We tell guys to get outside their comfort zone, but at the same time, I think there has to be a consistency of message. So we can't grasp on to every new thing that's out there, especially before we've vetted it, because then we find it very hard to have a consistent approach on a day in and day out basis.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that we really try to do, and it doesn't necessarily come natural to me, is be even, be very consistent on a day in and day out basis in terms of how you deal with guys. Be very transparent in communication.
Yep.
Be very willing to over communicate the hard things in person. So we meet a lot. I meet a lot. Our staff meets every day. I still value meeting with players one-on-one in the office a lot. And I think that there's that relational piece is huge, but just if we're going to err on the side with communication, we're going to err on the side of over communication with
mm-hmm.
guys. And I think guys appreciate that. Guys don't like surprises. I've learned that. I realized the hard way. Like, I don't like being surprised. I don't like being caught off guard. Players don't either.
That's it.
And so if we're really proactive with our communication and really proactive with our planning, then we're not catching guys off guard. And I think they appreciate that. And I think it helps build credibility and trust.
Mm. You know, I spent 11 years coaching. This is my fourth year out of the game. And I was reflecting with a good friend this weekend. And he said, man, have you thought about getting back in coaching? I said, man, I love my job too much. I don't think it's for me. I said, but I'll tell you this. If I did get back in coaching, to your point, I'd be a much different coach because I'm a parent now. And I see things differently.
No question.
It's changed me in ways that I never thought were possible. But to your point, I think coaches are taking feverish notes on this one. Go into this. I think this is something, you know, you've played some really high-level baseball, especially the last few years, in the ACC, then moving to the NCAA tournaments, playing against teams all over the country. And sometimes you get to play teams that you normally don't have the opportunity to play in those regionals and those supers. So what's something that maybe you saw differently in the game, something that really challenged you a little bit to make, you know what, we could do something like that, or we could change what we do here. Can you point to something specifically?
Yeah, and this kind of goes back to this goes back to sort of what we're just talking about with the changes you make from being
mm-hmm.
a young coach to being an old coach. I spent a lot of time as a young coach. When I'd look across another dugout, I was constantly bombarded by the feeling that, hey, they know something I don't. Yeah. They got, you know, they're doing something we're not. They've got our signs. They've got some kind of throwing program we don't. Mm-hmm. And somewhere along the way, it occurred to me, well, if you really think they've got something, then why don't you pay attention to what they're doing, make some notes, and try to use it.
That's
so
it.
One of the things that we do now, and I keep a notebook in the dugout, and it's great. We're in a league with unbelievable coaches.
Yeah.
And so when you see something, and certainly this presented itself, you're playing great programs in the NCAA regionals, and you're playing great programs in a super, in a Texas Tech and a super, I just keep a notebook and I write notes. And so, you know, I remember being down at Florida State a couple years ago and watching something they were doing in pregame. And I said, man, I'd like that. You know, a screen set up right along the first baseline and the third baseline. I said, wonder why they're doing that. And I studied that and I couldn't figure it out. And finally, I asked Coach Martin, he said, we're going to want to keep guys hitting in the middle of the field, Chris. That's why we set those screens up. We don't want guys hooking balls during BP. You know, if you're hooking balls foul during BP, something's wrong with your approach. Boy, that makes a lot of sense. And I went back and wrote a note down, and that's an easy thing to bring home with you. Learned a lot from watching Brian O'Connor's teams at UVA and how they go about their business. He's got an unbelievable staff.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, just that willingness to learn from what other teams that even you're competing against in the moment, even when something happens, it burns you, you know, mm-hmm. even when a team does something and it maybe even costs you a game. Well, if you learn something from it that you can do with your own players, it's not all bad. As we were down playing a tremendous Troy team in the regional a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we were blown away by how good their two-strike approach was. You know, and these guys, they had really good athletes. They had recruited really well. But Coach Smart and his staff had done an unbelievable job of developing those guys. And it showed up in the draft. I think they had four positional players that went in the top 10 rounds.
Mm-hmm.
Really done a great job of coaching these guys on a two-strike mentality and culture. So, you know what we did the first time we ran into the Troy staff when we were out on the road? Coach Jordan's out recruiting. He's the hardest working recruiting coordinator.
Yes.
And associate coach in the country. But yeah, he ran into some of the Troy coaches on the road. And here we are, we're in between games waiting for a game to start. And he said, man, you got to tell me, what do you guys do with two-strike approach?
I love it.
And they sat there and had a great 20-minute conversation about how they teach two-strike approach. And, you know, and so that's something that we'll spend a lot of time talking about as a staff in August and finding out if there are ways that we can implement some of what they're doing into our own system when our guests get back on campus and get going in the fall. So I think the idea and the willingness to share ideas is huge. I'll never forget when I was at Appalachian State, Coach Moore and his staff went up and spent time at West Virginia learning the spread offense.
That's right.
You know, they were running a more traditional offense. This is before they went on a stretch of winning three national championships in Boone. And they spent time just with their staff. And I was always struck by the willingness of football programs to do that. And I think that's something that we – as a organization and a fraternity need to embrace is that willingness to share ideas. I never forget Cliff Godwin and his East Carolina squad. They make a habit out of kicking our butts on a regular basis, but they kicked their butt a year ago. And after the ball game was over, I said, Cliff, I said, I'm going to drive down to Greenville. And I want to spend half a day just meeting with you and talking about some of the things you do. Cause every time we play you guys, I always leave the ballpark with a feeling of, hey, we just played a really well-coached team.
Yeah.
And so there are some things there that if I'm feeling that feeling every time, you know, I want to learn and hear about some of the things you're doing to make guys better.
That's a high compliment. I love when coaches talk that way. It's a high compliment. Answer this question for me. How do you define success? And if you can define it, how's that changed for you over the years?
I'm going to answer this question from more of a holistic 10,000-foot view.
Mm-hmm.
First and foremost, success for me is it comes in the relationships, first and foremost, with your family.
Mm-hmm.
So the success for me comes first and foremost in watching my two sons grow up and see the men that they're turning into and the relationship that I have with my wife. And I always tell our coaches when I feel like I have concern that maybe we're pushing too hard. I said, listen, hey, if if we fail at this coaching thing, but we're good husbands and dads, right. At the end of the day, we're still going to look back and feel like we were successful people. Mm-hmm. If we want to want a bunch of ball games, but our family life suffers because of it, then we're going to go look back when we're 80 years old and feel like we had success in what we did. And so I think that's where success starts. And then I'd further define it on, you know, what is your relationship like with the former players in your program? Do they embrace the opportunity to come back? Do they want to celebrate with you when they get married, when they have a child? Do they want to stay engaged to the program? Because that I think speaks volumes to the culture that you have around what you do. Is do guys still want to be a part of it even when they're no longer, you know, in a sort of active duty, if you will?
Yeah, that's good.
And then I think the other way you got to define success in coaching, because we're all at varying points relative to the resources that we have, is what do you do? You define success by what you do with the resources that you have, mm-hmm. you know? And so that success is defined very differently at one place versus another. You know, there's a very wide landscape across our sport relative to facilities, relative to number of scholarships that the university is willing to invest in the program, or the league that you play in. And those things are certainly true at the high school level and all different levels of our sport. But mm-hmm. ultimately, all you can ever judge yourself on is what you're doing relative to those tools that you have at your disposal. For some places, that's going to be making their conference tournament. For some places, that's going to be, a 500 record. For other places, and based on the resources that they have, they should be in a regional every year, or they should be hosting a regional every year. So I think that you have to be careful about defining success by saying, well, we're going to be one of the final 64 teams playing college baseball.
That's right.
Because you may not be positioned to do that on a year in and year basis. That's not to say it's not possible, but that may not be the barometer for success. So the barometer for success is ultimately where I think there's a lot to be said for, do you leave a place better than you found it? Mm-hmm. That's another great way to define success.
Mm-hmm. So good. This is some pull back the curtain questions for us, Chris, that we love to pose to our podcast guests. I think it's a great way for guys to really get to know you and how you go about doing things. And I think let's start with daily habits or routines. So what are the things that maybe you do each day, or how do you set forth on a day? And then maybe some resources that you would share, a book that you've read recently. You've mentioned a couple already, podcasts or anything, any kind of resource you would offer. Take us into that one.
Well, so guys that know me, or certainly guys that have played for me, will get a chuckle when they listen to this. And you brought up routines, because we preach and harp on routines. And we call it process. But really, process is, as I learned from listening to Ken Revizza, is really just all your routines added up, if you will, right? So yeah. Your daily routine. I try to make a routine out of everything. I really do. And I challenge our players, and I challenge our coaching staff to do that, from getting up at the same time every day to going to bed at the same time every day. I've got a specific order that I brush my teeth, put deodorant on, and put sunscreen on in the morning. I want to be that detailed in terms of,
sure.
because I think that routine leads to efficiency. I think when you have a good routine and you're organized, it makes you more efficient. So your capacity to get things done in your day improves. Additionally, when you get on the field and you take those routines to the field with you, what it allows for you to do is clear your mind and I call it getting lost in your process. You become so focused on completion of your routines that dominates your approach more than the outcome. And so we have a sign in our hitting building, very simply, has the words process and outcome, and it has the word process over outcome, over top of outcome, because we always want the process to be the focus, not the outcome. And we want the process to be greater than the outcome. So that's where routine for me is huge. One of the things that I guess I would challenge guys on, and our staff gets sick of me talking about it, but one of the biggest changes I made in the last 3 years is my diet.
Okay.
And it's amazing how much that's impacted just my overall health and energy. And, you know, as you get older, that those things are harder to come by. Mm-hmm. And I think as coaches, we're wired that, you know what, we can grind through anything. And as a young coach, I can skip breakfast, I can skip lunch, and I'll have the same energy level I do at practice as I would had I taken time to do those things. But I think taking time to make sure that you have a healthy routine, that you're eating right, that you're resting right, that you're taking time out to exercise and do those things, I think I've found over the last 3 years has really made me a better coach, because when I get to the field, I've got a better energy about myself. When I go through practice, I'm more consistent on a day in and day out basis. So that's been a part of the routine that's changed for me over the last 3 years, I think has been big.
Any books, anything, any resources, any podcasts? How do you spend your time really learning? What are the avenues you take?
Like to read, need to do a better job with it. What I did was a couple years ago, I made a vow that if anybody felt strongly enough about me to give me a book, then I was going to take time to read it. So I had all these books that people had given me over my career sheets that I had just stuck on a shelf.
Yeah.
And you know, you'd look at it and go, hey, that was cool, thanks for doing that, but hadn't taken it. And so 3 or 4 years ago, I said, you know what, I'm just going to start pulling these books out. If Charlie Cobb cared enough about me to give me the book Energy Bus, then I'm going to take time to read it and see what I can learn from it. I met, you know, you've probably seen, we've been really involved over the last 3 years with the Special Operations Forces down at Fort Bragg. It's been a unique opportunity for us to go down there and train, and lessons in leadership and lessons in toughness. And Lieutenant Colonel Josh Rudd, who's developed a really close friendship with, was really instrumental in helping us get that relationship going with Special Forces and the Green Berets at Fort Bragg. And he shared a book with me, 10-Minute Toughness. I believe the author is Jason Selk. And that's a great read. I would want to share with coaches. I referenced the Mind Gym. I think that's a book that's been around for years. I've already referenced Revisa, but I love those books. And in fact, I bought both 1.0 and 2.0 at the ABCA convention. you know, those are a great read, specific to baseball. And we've talked routine development. We've talked mental toughness. We've talked about, you know, process. Those books deal directly firsthand with how those things are applicable in our sport.
That's it. Take us into the most humbling moment you've had in coaching. And there's got to be something that you still think about today that really grounded you, maybe brought you back to square one. What would that be?
So I'm going to give you two and both happened while I was at Appalachian State. One, maybe guys will get a chuckle about. The other, guys will look at me and go, well, you're still fortunate to have a job. the first one, so we were playing a 3-game series with Elon my first year at Appalachian State. And in that 3-game series, and people go, what? They scored, I think, 56 runs on us in 3 games.
Yeah.
And we were late in the season. We were very late in the season in a 10-42 campaign in 2005 at Appalachian. We were in the 7th inning of the Saturday game, and we literally, Sheets, couldn't get off the field. Ugh. We couldn't stop the bleeding. We couldn't stop the bleeding. And finally, our right fielder ran in from right field during one of the umpteen pitching changes that we made, ran in from right field and said to the runner standing at second base, hey, you guys are going to have to get out. You got to help us get off the field here.
Sure.
And I think he was semi-serious. Like, if you guys don't get out, this game may never end. Yeah, you know, to go through those moments and to be humbled in the ways that we all have in this game. We gave up 30 runs in one of the games that weekend. It helps you realize very quickly that, number one, you don't have it all figured out.
Yep.
That you still got a lot to learn about the game.
But number two, it also helps you appreciate the good times. Like I can still vividly remember walking into that coach's locker area at Radlacky Field after that weekend and how that felt and, you know, the disappointment and the embarrassment and all the things that you feel. And that makes it feel really good when you do, you know, experience some of the highs that we've been fortunate to experience in this game. The second was, you know, I had a moment, we were early in the 2011 season. It was my seventh season at Appalachian, and we'd gotten off to a really bad start in the league. We were like 1-8, I believe, in conference play. We were playing a really talented UNC Greensboro team, as coached by Mike Gaskey, and I think we left 14 runners on base on Friday night, and I felt like every inning we had a runner at third, less than two, and we were terrible at getting those guys in from third base, and wound up losing the game. It was a close ball game. We lost it like 5-3, but we had just chance after chance after chance, and we'd fall into a really bad place in the league. And Sheets went in the bathroom there at the ballpark at UNC Greensboro and really showed my rear end. And it was very obvious to our players. It was very obvious to our players' parents. It was obvious to the UNC Greensboro staff and their players what was going on. And I'll tell you, Mike Gaskey showed me a lot of mercy and a lot of compassion that next day when I showed up at the ballpark. And I'll never forget that, and I appreciate that. And we actually wound up developing a good friendship out of that moment when a guy kind of put his arm around a coach who was in a bad place over the way his team was playing. And you know, and I've always appreciated that. And I'll tell you, when I see coaches in that kind of spot, you know, we've all been there where you're wondering if you're ever going to be able to turn the tide. I have a lot of empathy for those guys, and now to the point where when you're on the winning side of those kind of ball games, you're still thinking about how that other guy feels in the dugout, because you know how he feels because you've been there. You know, Coach Whalen from Dartmouth told a great story. We were at our Lefty Gomez committee meeting at the ABCA this past January, and he was telling stories about Coach Kendall, and he had an awesome story about how when he was an assistant in Maine and they went out and played Coach Kendall's squad in a regional, and they were up big. Maine was up big, and Arizona came back and won the game in a walk-off. And Coach Kendall went over and put his arm around Coach Whalen and said, "Hey, I know that losing these types of games hurts a lot worse than winning these types of games feels good." And he just showed compassion in that moment. That story really stuck with me, because I think we've all been on both sides of that equation.
Right. Definitely have. Any hidden talents or hobbies in there, Chris? Anything you'd offer?
No. I
nothing.
Terribly untalented. You know, can't carry a tune in a shower, can't draw a stick figure.
Man.
I do have a few hobbies. I've got two sons that are avid outdoorsmen, so we like to camp and we like to hike and we like to fish and really enjoy being in the outdoors and sharing that time with those guys. We love to kayak. So that's my escape is getting out on the river and casting a line in the water, and that's a place where I could be. It kind of takes you away from the day-to-day stress of coaching. Yeah. And then I guess the only other thing is just try to, you know, we're all kind of fighting off old age. So any chance to get, like, to try to work out and stay healthy. But those times can be a challenge when you're in the season or when you're in the recruiting season. But in terms of talents, I don't have any. Really don't. I always talk with our coaches' sheets about the embarrassment of riches that our players have. These guys, you know, they can sing, they play an instrument, they're talented enough to play baseball at the ACC level. Obviously, they're incredibly bright because they're at Duke. And I'm just like, man, save some for the rest of us.
Yeah. I will let you know that, I mean, this is a vote of confidence. Maybe this is me being an energy giver here. Everybody sounds good in the shower. So I just want you to, tomorrow morning, work.
So maybe I should try it more often.
Just work it into the routine. That's all I'm asking, is maybe that's part of your process in the morning. Belt out a tune, start your day, then go brush your teeth in the systematic way that you do. give it a shot.
I like it. I like that. I'll give it a shot.
Do that. Offer us up this, just funniest story that's hit you over the years, one that still cracks you up today. What would you offer?
So it's not even technically a baseball story, but it is a story about my baseball career. When I got to Appalachian State in the fall of 2004, and at the time, we didn't have any kids, and Steph was still back in Albemarle teaching, and we were trying to figure out what we were going to do. We were going to buy a house. We're going to buy a condo. And Bud Martin, who owns a real estate company up in Boone, he's actually cousins with Mike Martin at Florida State, and that's how we got hooked up with him. He was our real estate agent, so he's driving us around. And anybody that's been in the mountains around Boone and Blowing Rock knows how the fog can blow in there, and you can't see in front of your face sometimes. It gets so thick. And so we had picked one of these evenings right after I was done with practice and workouts, and we're riding around. It's about 7 o'clock, and the fog sets in, and we're riding around Blowing Rock. So we went and looked at this condo, and Bud says, "Hey, going back out and get in the car, and I'll turn everything off, lock up, and we'll head to the next place." So I went back out, sat in the car, and a couple minutes go by, and Bud doesn't come out, and feels like he's taking maybe longer than he should, and sitting there, just waiting, and we're going to ride to the next place. And all of a sudden, this vehicle pulls up behind the car and honks a horn. And so I couldn't see anything because of the fog. So I just sat there and waited and minded my own business. And then the horn honks again, and kind of, well, what's this guy want? I'm new to the area. I'm just going to, stick to my own business. And finally, guy lays on the horn and screams out, "Coach! Coach, where are you?" And keep in mind, 15, 20 minutes has gone by at this point. And it's Bud. And I realize that in the fog that I have walked out and I've gotten in the wrong car.
Oh, my gosh.
And I'm sitting in the wrong automobile waiting for 20 minutes while Bud's been riding around in the fog trying to find me.
Manja.
And so every time I go back to Boone, if I ever run into Bud, we have a good laugh about me walking out in the fog and getting in the wrong car.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. You've mentioned so many of these guys. I'm guessing a lot of these will show up in this question, but we always like to pose it for our guests and give them the opportunity to really send some shout outs to the people that have impacted them the most in their personal Mount Rushmore. So if you could, what are the three or four people you would exalt up, Chris?
For sure. But first and foremost, my dad and my grandfather, I learned, so much about being a man and just approaching life and fatherhood and being a husband, from those two. I was really close with my grandfather, passed away 4 years ago. He was like, I had two dads growing up and was really, really fortunate in that regard. I grew up in a house right beside his, and I tell people, and I said this, I had a chance to speak in front of a group a couple years ago. My dad was the hardest working person I've ever been around, even to this day, and still has the capacity to outwork me just learned so much about work ethic and being a grinder and being the same guy every day from watching him go about his business and what he did for our family. And then I got to Davidson and learned about baseball and how to play the game and how to understand the game and ultimately how to teach the game from being around Dick Cook and still one of my closest friends on the planet. My wife says we talk like sisters because we get on the phone and we gab and gab and gab.
Sure.
Not just the mentorship, but also the friendship from being around Coach Cook. And, and that fourth, it's so difficult to put a fourth guy up there in that Rushmore because there's so many people that I been blessed to be around. I've worked for 12 years now with Josh Jordan, and he would be right up there with my dad in terms of the hardest working people that I've ever been around.
Wow.
And incredibly loyal, incredibly tough-minded. He's made me a better person. He's made me a better coach by the 12 years we spent together. The thing I always tell people about Coach Jordan, you know, this tells you how much I thought about him, because I tried to hire him three different times. The first two times I tried to hire Josh, he turned me down for the position. And that was when I was at Appalachian. Finally, the third time I offered it to him, and I told him, I said, listen, I'm not going to, you turn me down again, I'm done. I'm not going to offer you any more jobs. But I was lucky he took the job on that third try. We've been working together now for 12 years. And that's a guy that I have an unbelievable amount of respect for. And I can tell you this, Sheets, anywhere that we've worked together, whether it was Appalachian or here at Duke, we wouldn't be in the positions of success that we've been fortunate to be in had Josh not been part and parcel part of it.
Oh, my gosh. You know, being around so many great people, mentioning Coach Jordan, Coach Cook, all the different folks that you've interacted with, and obviously that players factor into this as well, or teammates that you had in the game. What are the best qualities that jump off to you? What are the things that are easy to pinpoint? And if you're really defining someone's character, describe the best qualities that come up out of those people that you've been around in baseball.
I think one of the most important and perhaps most underrated qualities in our sport is the ability to be the same guy every day. Mm-hmm. And that sounds like a really simple thing, but it is so important in our sport. And I think about guys that I played with who've been very successful at different levels of the game, and now guys that I've coached. And I think about a guy like Wes Hobson I coached at Appalachian State, who's one of the most decorated players in the history of that program, and it really in the Southern Conference. A guy, Ty Zubcik, who played for me at Appalachian State's dad, Bob, played in the big leagues, and Ty was an unbelievable player and leader. He's stayed in the game now, and it's great. He's here in the community with Baseball Rebellion. And I think about guys that we've had, like Nick Hendricks, who is, when he finished his career here at Duke, he was the active leader for appearances in NCAA with something like 117 appearances over his career as a pitcher here. And then most recently, a guy like Jimmy Herron, who was drafted in the third round by the Cubs, who's a tremendous player. Max Miller, who was a captain for us on this 2018 squad. All those guys had a very similar way about them, that they were the same guy every day. Whether you were in the midst of a five-game winning streak or a five-game losing streak, they could be 11 for their previous 20 at-bats, or they could be 0 for 20, and they were going to show up at the ballpark, and their routine was going to stay the same. Mm-hmm. Their demeanor was going to stay the same. They were going to remain poised. So that's a huge part of being successful in our sport. And then the other quality that I think is so important in any team dynamic is when guys have the ability to be selfless.
Yeah.
When guys truly, and that's something we all talk about and guys aspire to, but there are very few guys that are truly have the ability to consistently put the needs of the people around them in front of their own goals or their own objectives or their own needs. And when you find guys like that, those are the guys that can really allow for you to have a special culture.
That is powerful. Last question I got for you. You've offered so much inside this show, Chris. It's been just off the charts. Is there any other advice you have in your pockets? If you could empty those out for our guys, what else would you offer any coach paying attention to this show? Where would you send them?
Just be a lifelong learner, Sheets. I think that's the most important thing. Never get to a place where you feel like you've kind of got it figured out. I remember we were, my wife and I were sitting at a restaurant. It was my first year here at Duke, and we were 8-7. This is the 2013 squad. We were 8-7 in the ACC, and we were playing really well and exceeding expectations. And it was a Saturday night. We're sitting there at dinner, just the two of us. Feel like kind of got some things figured out as a coach. And I said that out loud.
Yeah.
Right?
Whoops.
This is in the middle of a season, and we won one out of our next 18 ACC ball games.
Of course.
And so this game has a unique ability when you think you've got it figured out to really humble you in a hurry. I would really challenge guys to be lifelong learners and constantly be absorbing information and looking at ways to grow. And we talk about this all the time with our players, so we got to be good at this as coaches. We got to look at failure from a growth mindset and really look at it not as something that's a setback, but as an opportunity to learn and get better.
I love it. Chris, this has been outstanding. I know the feedback is going to pour in on this one just because you've offered so much. It's so tangible inside this. And more than that, I'm right back where we started, man. One of the great people in college baseball. I'm so thankful we have men like you inside the ABCA. You're right down the street from me. You're a stone's throw away, so we get to spend some time together. But, Chris, thanks again for jumping on the call with us. We wish you, Coach Jordan, the rest of the staff, the Duke Blue Devils, the very best the rest of the summer, and have a great season next year.
Really appreciate you having me on, Sheets. It's an honor, humble to be on with you, and really value the relationships that we have inside the ABCA.
Thanks so much for dialing into our Calls from the Clubhouse podcast and checking out another one of our Dugout Chatter episodes. Now, here at the American Baseball Coaches Association, we are here to serve coaches around the world, so let us know how we can help. Head over to our website, abca.org, for more information. Make sure you're following us on Twitter, at ABCA1945. You can also find us on Facebook as well. And feel free to reach out to me directly on Twitter, at CoachSheets3, or by email at Sheets, S-H-E-E-T-S, at ABCA.org. We'd love to hear from our loyal members and continue to find ways to keep growing this game together. As always, coaches, thank you for listening in and staying dialed into our Calls from the Clubhouse podcast. Until next week, coaches, keep growing, keep developing, keep challenging yourself inside this game. We wish you and your club the very best, and thank you for what you're doing for the game of baseball.